Today on New Horizons, former NASA astronaut Barbara Morgan, now Boise State's distinguished educator in residence.
Everybody knows that space exploration is really, really important to the future of our country, to the present and the future. And we are leaders in the world in this area, and we want to remain leaders in the world in this area. And as a school teacher, we work hard to encourage our students to take risks. We want them to risk an opinion, which is really hard to do around your colleagues. I can't think of anything more important to our kids than to keep the future open for them. And space exploration is a great way to keep the future open for them.
I'm Bob Custra, president of Boise State University. Welcome to New Horizons. When Idaho's Barbara Morgan blasted into space on August 8, 2007, aboard the Space Shuttle Endeavour, she became the first teacher to complete a successful mission for NASA. That mission was the culmination of many years of training and preparation. In 1985, Barbara was selected as a backup astronaut for the Teacher in Space program. She trained side by side with fellow teacher Krista McAuliffe and witnessed the 1986 Challenger shuttle explosion that killed McAuliffe and her six fellow crew members. Following the accident, Barbara continued to work with NASA and conducted many of the visits McAuliffe would have made, talking to teachers and students around the country. In 1998, Barbara Morgan was selected by NASA to train as a mission specialist. 9 years later, in August of 2007, she served on the crew of STS-118 on an assembly mission to the International Space Station. Barbara began her career in 1974 on the Flathead Indian Reservation in Montana before moving to McCall Donnelly Elementary School in McCall, where she taught second through fourth grades for 20 years. Last May, Boise State University honored Barbara with an honorary doctorate. In August, she began a new career at Boise State as distinguished educator in residence, where she is focused on using a variety of tools to improve students' exposure to science, technology, engineering, and math education. Barbara Morgan, welcome to New Horizons, but even more importantly, welcome to Boise State University.
Well, thank you, Dr. Custra. As you know, I'm just thrilled to be here, and I'm glad to be a Bronco.
Well, we're thrilled to have you be a Bronco, and the last couple of days have just been a wonderful opportunity for our students and our faculty to get to know you, but of course they're going to have a long time to do that as you settle in at the colleges of engineering and education and work with our students and work with much younger students in attracting them to science, technology, education, engineering, and math. Let's talk for a moment, if we could, though, about your background with NASA. First of all, help us understand the nature of NASA as an organization. What's so different about it? If you look back in your career, I'm sure you're going to say NASA was without a doubt the most unique place. I shouldn't say most unique. That's the unique place that you have ever worked. Help us understand why that is.
Well, actually, there's a lot of similarities between NASA and schools, universities, schools, kindergarten, elementary school, middle schools, high schools, because you have people who are essentially doing the same thing. They are exploring, they're learning, and they're discovering and then sharing those discoveries. And that's what happens in our schools, too, which makes it fun to do both. The difference is, rather than doing everything here on Earth, we're doing it out in space. And that is a very, very unique environment with very unique challenges. But the similarities are people who have a goal in mind, who are working together on huge goals with huge challenges, and doing it with enthusiasm and a we can do it kind of attitude.
Now, the typical elementary school from which you came, for example, is a flat organizational structure. That's to say that there's teachers spread all out across the school. They're all equal to each other. They work with each other and, of course, with their students. And there's not a lot of hierarchy. There's a principal in the building and there's an assistant principal, but that's about it. How does
there's
that
also a school board.
And that's right. There is
and
a school
board.
And there's
the parents. And, way
at the top.
And there's the parents.
But it's not as hierarchical as a good number of organizations our listeners are affiliated with, where there's steps and steps and steps of hierarchy before you ever get to the top, and a lot of bureaucracy. I just wonder about NASA. Is it a flat organization like you find in elementary and secondary education, let's say, or is it just because of its complexity and the difficulty of its mission, also layers and layers of bureaucracy, if you will?
Well, there's definitely a hierarchy, and actually it's really interesting because you've got NASA headquarters, and they are the leaders of the organization. First of all, it's an executive branch. It's the office of the president, and they work with the Office of Management and Budget, with Congress, with the president. And that sets the policy for the country. So as an arm of the executive branch, they carry out the policies of the executive branch. And then at the various NASA centers, they serve to make that policy happen, mm-hmm. and do the day-to-day work, whether it's in aeronautics or in space exploration, whether it's basic science, all of those things. Mm-hmm. So, and then at each center, of course, you've got a whole hierarchy too. So, it's very, very complex. Mm-hmm. And I think what makes it complex, but what also makes it wonderful, is the NASA centers are all around the country. So we've got the NASA Johnson Space Center in Houston. We've got the Ames Research Center out in California. In Southern California, there's a Jet Propulsion Laboratory. We've got the Marshall Space Flight Center in Alabama, the Glenn Research Center in Ohio, Langley Research Center out in Virginia, and the Stennis Space Center in Mississippi. And then the other big part of it is all of the contractors that contribute, you know, that are doing the work as well. So it's a huge organization.
The contractors being the private sector organizations that would contract with NASA to deliver on a particular program or a shuttle or whatever it might be, whatever they're making.
Absolutely, yeah. Both in the making and in the day-to-day running of the operations. For example, USA, who, and I hate to mention one because there are many, many, many contractors involved, but who might do the shuttle operations. But it's a partnership with NASA and NASA oversight and our contractors. And then I think the thing that really surprised me as I learned more and more about this are the many people all across the country who contribute. In fact, in Northern Idaho, there's a subcontractor that makes one of the little widgets for one of the little parts for some of our space vehicles. Mm-hmm. And this is all over the country.
Well, you mentioned that NASA is a part of the executive branch of government. And, of course, anyone would understand, I suppose, that in order for NASA to be successful, it's going to have a healthy budget, and that budget comes from Congress. We're going to talk a little bit, if we have time today, about the future of space exploration. But before we get to that, let's talk about what allows for the future and space exploration, and that's that budget. What is the relationship today between NASA and Congress? Is it a healthy, solid relationship? Are there any leftover feelings from the latest two accidents, Challenger and Columbia, that have some doubting Thomases hanging around those appropriation committees that are still trying to figure if this is all worth it, given the incredible investment of technology and, most importantly, the loss of life, even though, of course, that's that doesn't happen every day, obviously, in NASA. Help us understand, what kind of a take do you have today on NASA and its relationship to Congress?
I personally feel, and I think a lot of just about everybody will tell you the same thing, NASA has a great relationship with Congress, both the in all the branches of government. And everybody knows that space exploration is really, really important to the future of our country, to the present and the future. And we are leaders in the world in this area, and we want to remain leaders in the world in this area. And everybody also knows how important it is for the international aspect of what we're doing with the International Space station. It's absolutely fantastic. Mm-hmm. And it does bring people together from all over. So I have a personally a very good feeling for everything that's going on, and we really get a lot of support.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've seen you in so many different venues here in Boise talking to people, and you're simply beloved in the way people react to you and relate to you. But I have to ask this question. In your long history with NASA, going out and speaking to so many different constituencies, have you ever encountered taxpayers who ask the tough questions like, how come you're doing this and why is it costing us so much money? Have you ever really had to deal with the negatives that come out occasionally?
Yeah, sure. People ask about that. And, and this is way above my pay grade level to talk about because I really don't know. You know, I can tell you a lot about certain areas, but there are a lot of things I don't know about. But I do know that less than, and this is a surprise to people, because oftentimes when you hear about a satellite or about a certain program at NASA, especially in the media, it usually comes with this price tag. And that's always mentioned, that how many gazillions, I like to use that word, of dollars it costs it. And those numbers are so big that I personally have a hard time even grasping what those numbers mean. But when you learn that less than 1% of the budget is spent on space exploration, and we talked about what a huge program this is across the country, mm-hmm. and how important it is both nationally and internationally, and you realize that less than 1% of the budget is used for that. And some of my colleagues can tell you they've got these fun facts and figures that they can throw out, like how that compares to how much we spend on Halloween candy.
Or potato chips or whatever.
Exactly. Exactly. And I can't keep all those numbers in my head, but that less than 1% is really small in comparison. Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't pretend to speak for all the people or most of the people or even some of the people that listen to you talk out there on the hustings, but I have to believe that many people react to you the way I do, because we still have this vivid memory of what happened to Krista McAuliffe and her crew members, and we have this vivid memory of what happened in February of 2003 to the Columbia when it was attempting reentry. And so we're looking at you, and you're a pretty normal person in some respects. That is, you were a teacher for a long time in McCall, an elementary school teacher. And normally, elementary school teachers are not supposed to be looking at two disasters like that and saying, oh, no big deal. I think I'll fly into space after them. And so the question becomes, first of all, what was your basic approach to how you dealt with the fact that this is a doggone dangerous occupation I'm about to get into here? But then secondly, if in fact you might have had moments where you were thinking, like I still would be thinking about a challenge like that, I can't believe I'm going to do this, then what does the training do to help you and your crew members overcome some of that? And forgive me, but I would suspect that some of your crew members who have spent their life piloting aircraft, jet aircraft, and have, you know, broken the speed of sound, I mean, I think it's going to be a little different for them than it will be for a layperson like yourself. And again, I'm just putting myself in your shoes and imagining what it's like. Help us through that. What's it like overcoming fear, if you ever had it? Maybe you never even had it.
Oh, no, I've had plenty of fear. Used to be afraid of heights, to tell you the truth. And I'll tell you, remind me to tell you a story about that, because it had to do with space shuttles. But first of all, those are great questions, and it's important stuff to talk about. And I think we do need to talk about risk. And secondly, I beg to differ about our elementary school teachers. I agree with you about the normal and very, very average.
Yeah.
So, and that's what I want people to know is that, or to see, not know, but see. And I hope as we go out and work with our young people throughout the state and elsewhere, that they will see an average person, you know, not like them, because they're going to be more, you know, more than average.
Right.
But an average person, somewhat similar to themselves, that is doing things that's fun and exciting and part of living on this planet, and that those are things that they can do too. Mm-hmm. And that if I can do it, anyone can do it.
But the thing is, most of us, well, I won't say most of us, I'll just speak for those timid college presidents like like Bob Custer would not raise their hand and say, okay, I'll go next. I mean, it's just there's only some of us who are willing to take the plunge. And you were willing to take the plunge. And most normal folks admire what you did. But I'm not so sure they necessarily, if tomorrow somebody called them and said, hey, guess what? You get to go next. They're going to say, that's okay. Pass on me and call me next week.
Okay. Well, two things. One, it's if people don't want to do it, nobody has to do it.
Right, right.
And secondly, you know, you are taking huge risks and you're doing a wonderful job at it. And you are plunging right into things. Look what we're doing with the what you're doing with the university here. It's phenomenal. And don't tell me that doesn't take a lot of guts and courage to do that. It's fabulous. So I'm throwing it right back at you.
Right, good.
But the risk is really important. And as a school teacher, we work hard to encourage our students to take risks. You want them to take risks. You don't want them to take the foolish risks, which they see a lot of on television and elsewhere in the world. But we want them to risk an opinion, which is really hard to do around your colleagues. Risk asking those questions, especially if you think it's going to embarrass you and embarrass you in front of everyone else. And when you learn that everybody else, many of them also have the same question, but they don't have the courage to ask the same question, you're actually doing them a favor by asking that question. So to risk venturing opinion, risk trying something new, because that's how you're going to learn, it's important. So to me, it was very important that our kids see adults taking risks, not for risk's sake, but for the right reasons. And if we don't take any risks at all, we're not going to go anywhere. We're not going to learn anything. So that was part of my commitment and part of all the rest of our colleagues. And I have to say that our teachers, we have teachers working day in and day out in environments that overall are much more risky because of the day-to-day aspect of it than those of us who fly to the International Space Station or fly on Soyuz or fly on shuttle and who will fly on Orion back to the moon and on our vehicles onto Mars. And, you know, they go into schools that, you know, when you and I were in school, we didn't have metal detectors and they work in extreme situations and they do it because they care so much about those kids and providing those kids with an education. And that's the same reason for people taking the risk to go into space. You weigh the risk and you decide if it's worth it. You work hard at it and you go for it. And I can't think of anything more important to our kids and their future than to keep the future open for them. And space exploration is a great way to keep the future mm-hmm. open for them. And then once you make that decision, you go forward with a happy heart. And you work hard at it, too. And you you do everything you can. And the group, the team around you, I mean, everybody at NASA is, safety is the number one thing at NASA. And everything that we do, safety always is the very first on the topic. And it is very risky when you look at how complex this stuff is, the machinery, and how it all has to work together well. And then you throw human nature in on it, and humans make mistakes. That's all part of it. But you work really hard to try to minimize the risks, and you train so that you can do your job as best you can to help minimize those risks as well.
You're listening to Barbara Morgan. She is Distinguished Educator in Residence here at Boise State University and, as we all know, a former astronaut. So what about those moments, those fleeting moments when you're thinking, ooh, boy, I don't know. Is this going to work? Am I going to come back? Do you have those moments?
Well, I'd love to tell you a funny story.
Sure.
And this was back when Krista and I were starting out in the teacher and space program. I really, truly was afraid of heights. Okay.
This is the first time I've heard this, is an exclusive on this show.
And actually, I've also learned, and I didn't know this, that there are pilots and there are shuttle pilots who are afraid of heights as well. Now, go figure.
That's good.
But I'll never forget the first time we were out at the Kennedy Space Center and we were out at the launch pad and we had a tour of the shuttle that was on the pad ready to launch. And we were way up high at the highest point and looking, you know, you look down and there's nothing there. And it was a windy day. And I remember holding on really tightly to the railing and thinking, I'm going to get blown off of here. And then I thought, you know what, this is of any time to be afraid of heights, this is probably the stupidest time in my life to be afraid of something like this. So I just had to kind of work my way through it. And that didn't mean it just went away like this, because it didn't, but it was something I had to work mm-hmm. at. So,
well, when you were watching these other flights, these shuttles that didn't make it, especially the Columbia, because now where were you when the Columbia in February of 2003 didn't make it back upon reentry? Where were you in your program at that moment?
Well, we were actually, our crew was the next crew to fly on Columbia. So we had already been, we had already been assigned. And that was after Columbia returned. And then there were going to be a couple other flights. And Columbia, you know, would be gotten ready for STS-118. That was going to be our mission. So that's where we were. We were really close and very excited about you know, having our buddies come home and learning from them, and then getting that orbiter turned around so that we could fly on it.
So aside from the fear of seeing them not come back, the first thing you had to be thinking is, will I go up at all? Because what's going to happen to the program? I assume that just as after the Challenger, you must have had some concern that is this going to be suspended and is this going to be delayed? And as a matter of fact, it was delayed, wasn't it?
Yes, it was. And actually, you know, I did not have a fear of what would happen because of what happened on Columbia. And I did not have a fear of what would happen because of what happened on Challenger. That was not the emotion that I had. The emotion that I had was extreme sadness. And that never goes away. It gets better, but it never goes away. And it's a horrible thing for our country to lose great people. And NASA, everybody at NASA went to work really hard after both Challenger and Columbia to do the right thing and figure out what went wrong. And more important than that, what did we do that was wrong, and how are we going to fix it and keep moving forward and try to make things safer as we go. So it really wasn't a fear. And everybody got buried deep right away, just like they do, you know, just like the people here at Boise State. You see people, you know, going 100%, 100 miles an hour, fully engaged in this exciting stuff that's going on here. And that's exactly what happens at NASA. And even in the darkest hours, it's not done with enthusiasm as far as, you know, we're working on a great thing. It's done with real seriousness that we've got to fix this and we've got to keep the future open. And, mm-hmm. and so you saw the same thing. People just, you know, nobody retreated. Everybody came together even more so to mm-hmm. make it happen. And people from all over the country came. We had fire crews from Idaho coming out to the North Texas area where Columbia came down, helping with all of the rescue and the search and the pulling all the, finding all the pieces and everything to put all that stuff together so that the experts at NASA could figure out, the experts both within and outside of NASA, figure out what exactly went wrong and how can we overcome this. Mm-hmm.
I'm fascinated by hearing you talk about your relationship with your fellow crew members and how you get to know them so well. And I guess I'm thinking of a university like Boise State, where with over 550 faculty members walking around, I meet faculty every day who don't know faculty on the other end of campus, the College of Engineering faculty are in one end of campus, and they don't have a chance to meet the College of Education faculty, and sometimes may not meet each other until well into their tenures here at Boise State. What's it like when you're a crew member? For example, the Krista McAuliffe crew, the Columbia crew that didn't make it back in 2003. Do you work closely with crew members who are not necessarily on the crew you're on, and do you get to know them very well, or are you crews working somewhat independently because everybody's focused on their own mission, and so not a lot of time to go socialize with crew members from other places. How does that work in NASA?
Actually, it works really, really well, and it's from the very first moment that you come on board, and it's not just in the astronaut world, but it's whether you're in mission control or whether you're the engineers designing and building all of that. But I'll talk to you about the astronaut office because that's where I have the most experience. When you first come in, you come in as a class. So we have just like your third grade class, or your high school senior class. We have a class of astronauts, and we are called ASCANs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's what you're called.
I think
for.
You can say that on the air.
I hope so. Anyway, so you come in as a class, and you work very hard as a class, and that class gets very, very close. And there are reasons for that, because these are the people that you're going to be flying with and taking care of. Taking care of each other.
So now, what's the normal size of that class?
It varies. It can go from 6 or 13 to 31 or 35.
And what's the total number of people in the organization then? In the program.
Roughly, and it's a little bit smaller right now, but roughly about 150.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And but again, that grows and shrinks depending on the needs of the program, and the classes come in anywhere from every couple years to every maybe 4 years. Again, depending on the needs of the program. And it's not just the immediate needs, but they our bosses spend a long, hard time looking at projecting out to the future and what are we going to need? What do we have now? What are we looking at? And what are we going to need in the future? Mm-hmm. And they do a great job with that. Mm-hmm. So you come in as a class, but when you come in, the very first thing is you also get a sponsor. So one of the astronauts in the more senior astronauts and their families take on the new astronauts as sponsorees, and they're there to help you out, to get you settled, and also be there as your mentors and guides in whatever way you want. And the other thing that happens is when you first join, you share an office with some of your fellow classmates, but also with senior astronauts, and it's all mixed up so that you have people right there to pick their brains, and it's wonderful. And so there's a lot of sharing of expertise and experience. When you're in the simulators, those who have flown, and you're going through an actual simulation, practicing with the mission control team, those who have flown, once you've flown, you're there to help to do the job, but you're also there to just help and give tips to the newer people who haven't flown. Every Monday morning, we get together and have our Monday morning CB. That happens to be the mail code, but we call it our Monday morning meeting. And everyone, the heads of the chiefs of our various branches, all sit at the head table, and everyone goes around the table and also open up to the whole group to share what's current, what's going on, what are some of the challenges. And after every single mission, when the crew comes back, they always debrief the rest of the office and share lessons learned and things to look mm-hmm. for. And so there's just a lot of sharing that's going on mm-hmm. all the time. And it is very much a family.
Are crew members on their own when it comes to the housing situation? So you commute to work every morning like everybody else in Houston, for example?
Yes, everybody lives wherever they want to live. Some folks live downtown and they take a long commute against traffic. That's mm-hmm. that's a good thing. Others live right behind, very close to the center. So people live really, really anywhere. We have some families who actually their spouses maybe, have careers that may be in Boston, Massachusetts, or way on the other side of the country, and they're actually doing commuter family marriages mm-hmm. and things like mm-hmm. that. So we were very lucky. It was very important, especially being from Idaho and living and working in McCall. And we love Boise because everything, you're 15 minutes away from anywhere. Mm-hmm. And that's not the case in Houston. Houston's huge. Mm-hmm. So we actually moved into a neighborhood right behind the Space Center, as close to Space Center as we could be. And my drive to work, it was closer from home to the back gate than it was from the back gate to our office. Mm-hmm.
Barbara Morgan, thank you for joining us today on New Horizons. Next week, the second part of our interview with Barbara. The engineer for today's show is Brad Campbell. Research by Kathleen Craven. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Custra. Please join me next week as we talk to the people who help shape our world in both the Treasure Valley and beyond on New Horizons.